Welcome, everyone. Welcome. So I think I'm going to take us through all of the material. Okay, so let's begin. We're going to get to know the Maharal through three introductions, okay? His three introductions. Here's the Maharal of Prague. Here again, just so you know, Morenu Ha Rabbi Loi, Rabbi Loi. So that's how we get Maharal, and there are his dates. Okay, so three introductions, the first introduction, and the place that the Maharal starts is an important place. Both the verse that he starts with and then the midrash on that verse. And the verse that he starts with is a verse from Proverbs, and the verse is Kvod Elohim Hester Davar, the glory, this is hard to translate, but the glory of God is in hiding something or concealing a matter. Uchvod Malachim Chakor Davar. And the glory of kings is in investigating something. Okay, that's as much of Mishlei as that's a little opaque, but I'll just say, when we talk about kings and God, we're saying basically divine powers and then lowly human powers. So it isn't king specific, but just people are like this and God is like this. And God's glory is, and you might have translated it also, a hidden thing. God's glory is a hidden thing, but the glory that we have access to is worth investigating. Okay, that's, parsing this verse is a little difficult, but let's move quickly to the Midrash here in Bereishit Rabbah. And this is the way the Maharal often writes. He will cite a long piece of Midrash, and then he will explain, you know, go on for pages explaining it. So this is the Midrash that he starts by citing in Bereishit Rabbah. And in Bereishit Rabbah, Rabbi Levi, in the name of Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina, said, Mitchilat Sefer Bereshit ad Vayechulu Kvod Elokim Hester Davar. So from in the beginning until Vayechulu Hashemayim Ba'aretz, until the work of the heavens and the earth were finished, meaning the story of the 6 days of creation, that is the glory of God is in hiding something. From that point on, Chakor Davar. And here, the way it's used, it becomes almost like a command. From that point on, go ahead, investigate. Go ahead and investigate. Now, what that seems to mean is you will not understand creation. That is beyond you. It is hidden. It is concealed. And you might, maybe, you might as well not even bother because it's a concealed thing. And that's not for you to investigate. After creation, the rest of history, the rest of existence, that you can figure out, but how the world came to be, that's Hester Davar, that's a hidden thing. So go ahead and investigate everything after, but don't pretend to understand the mysteries of creation. Okay, I want to just say that it's interesting that we're talking about creation because the Mishnah and then the Maimonides often speaks about creation as the thing you can understand, the natural world, and the Merkava, the chariot, is like there's a mystical level you can't understand. But the Maharal here is starting by saying creation itself is, or the Midrash is saying creation is something that is concealed beyond our comprehension. So why is this important? Because it is clear that the Maharal's opening gambit here shows that he is interested in hidden matters, in things that the distinction between that which is hidden and that which is revealed, that which we can know and that which we cannot know. It's a kind of, to use a $10 word, epistemology. What is possible for us to know and how do we know it? There's hidden stuff and there is revealed stuff. So that's one of the primary, remember, the hidden in the language of the revealed. That was one way of describing the Maharal. So here the Maharal is dealing with the hidden and the revealed. Okay, but what he says about it, and this is the first point in the first introduction here, what he says about the realm of the hidden is not necessarily a mystical thing to say. Instead, this Maharal, this point, feels like it comes more from the philosophical side of him. So listen to what he says here about how we know things, okay? He says, there's a difference. Hefresh yesh bin ha-chokhma uven ha-nevuah. There's a difference between wisdom and prophecy. Okay. Now, wisdom, we associate with thinkers, philosophers, the sages themselves, and prophecy, wow, that's, you have to be touched by God. I might think that prophecy is better than wisdom. But there's a difference, and listen to the difference. Ki chacham yasig mitzad sichlo, because the wise apprehend through their intellect. Umikivan shehu yasig mitzad sichlo, and since they apprehend through their intellect, yuchal la'asig hadvarim hane'elamim v'hanistarim biyoter. They are therefore able to apprehend things that are more hidden. Ne'elamim, hidden and concealed, more. Okay? But the prophet, it seems like, wait a minute, the wise have an advantage over the prophets, it seems like, more hidden. And indeed, that's right. The prophet is called a chose, a visionary. They see a vision, a chazon, or a seer, a roeh. And he says that's a fitting term because they roeh hadavar mibachutz. They see something from outside, the exterior of something. Okay? And that is why lekach tzarich kol nevi hitdabkut b'davar asher nevuato bo. The prophet needs some attachment to, he says, the thing which the prophecy is about, which I think in this case means some image, some they need some tangible a depiction in front of them, and they become attached to that thing. There's more to say about this. We are scratching the surface of this dichotomy, but notice that the prophet is the one who experiences revelation, who experiences divine messaging. That's the one who sees they see something. And that's great. That's what prophecy is. Ezekiel tells us about his vision of the chariot. They see something, but seeing something, according to the Maharal, is like saying you don't fully understand. And you definitely don't understand the most hidden aspect of something because you're seeing itself is the apprehension of an exterior phenomenon. That's the way it is when we see. When I see you, I don't see who you are, the depths of your soul. I see just your exterior. So when the prophet is called a seer or a visionary, there's something about that that's actually limiting, even though we think of the prophet as having access to the ultimate forms of knowledge. Okay, whereas the wise one is able to apprehend things that the eye can't see, because the wise one can come to things through their intellect and therefore come to things which are not seeable, which are not exposed, but are in fact concealed. And then the Maharal ends with this quote, which is just a remarkable quote from the Talmud, but it becomes a touch point for the Maharal's thought, which is lefikach amru chachamim. That's why the sages said chacham adif minavi. A wise one, a chacham, is better than a prophet. Has superior powers of apprehension than a prophet. Okay, that is funny for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you look in, I say sages in the English, but in the Hebrew, it's the chachamim. We call them the chachamim. So it's like the chachamim are telling you that they are better than prophets. You know what I mean? So that's part of the irony or the connotation there is like a little bit of a wink. Like we are the ones who are really, and there's something about that gives you a sense of rabbinic thought. Like to think and to learn and to analyze is the highest form of engagement with God's truth, because that's what they did. They studied Torah. But for the Maharal to borrow this and use it and to say wisdom is the mechanism, the tool that we use to get to higher levels of knowledge, to get to divine knowledge, and to get to hidden things. Remember, the Maharal is interested in hidden things, has just distinguished layers of reality that are hidden and revealed, and seems to be suggesting that the hidden layers of reality, how do you get to them? You get to them through wisdom. And that means you get to them through the analytical, contemplative, logical, maybe logical is the wrong word, but using an inner logic, using the conceptual powers of your mind, rather than prophecy, which is a knowledge that comes to you through revelation and maybe even graphic depictions of impressions, words, sights that simply come to you that you can speak out, but that you may not fully apprehend, okay? So this is a strong statement for the Maharal to begin his work with, which is to say, we are interested in the hidden layers of reality, but we will use our minds to get to the essence of things, so to get to that hidden layer of reality, rather than I had a dream or I'm speaking to angels, or I simply am the carrier of hidden knowledge. No, we can think our way into the deepest mystical truths, okay? So that is, and the last thing I'll say about that first introduction is, you know, that sounds kind of abstract. Let me give you one example of what the Maharal means by that, and the example that he uses in this introduction is Olam Haba, the world to come. And that's a phrase the rabbis use all the time. But it's never clear exactly what it means. But somehow after this world, there'll be another world. Is it a world beyond? Is it a mystical world? But the point is, the prophets don't speak of Olam Haba. That's not something the Hebrew Bible mentions. The rabbis speak of it. And the Maharal, you can see where this is going, says that is because the prophets couldn't see Olam Haba because it was beyond their reality. They had no way of attaching themselves to it because they could. Prophecy can only work with the cognitive images that we have as people seeing things. But the sages, the chachamim, they could tell us about Olam Haba because they used their powers of chokhmah, of intellect, of reason, of sechel, of mind, to ascend, to understand something like Olam Haba. Okay? So that is the first introduction, and also is a strong indication of what kind of investigation this will be. It will be an investigation into hidden matters that will be using not secret knowledge or spiritual revelation, but instead the mind and the tools of thought of what we associate with philosophy. Okay, that's number one. That's introduction number one. Let's now head into introduction number two, and I think the most important of the three introductions. And here we begin to head also into our topic, or at least the topic of Gevurot Hashem, which is the Exodus. And as I said, Gevurot Hashem is a beautiful exploration of the whole Exodus story, but its chief concern, as the title suggests, is Gevurot Hashem, the powers of God. And therefore, the questions of how we understand the miracles and the plagues and the wonders and all the miracles and the signs and the wonders, that's languages all over Exodus. And it's those things that are displays of the powers of God. And it's those things that the book will be dealing with. And here in the second introduction, the Maharal, I just talked about his interest in hidden matters, and I started by saying that he is perceived as a mystical thinker, so we compared him to the Arizal. But here, in the second introduction, he really enters into a real classic philosophical debate, one that has been going on before him, and one that is a classic debate in the history of medieval Jewish thought. But his answer to the questions will be markedly different than the ones we saw in the medieval period. And here the Maharal offers us a vision of reality and of truth and of God that, when I encountered it, really radically reshaped my vision of Judaism and maybe of just religion and spirituality writ large. Okay, so we're going to head into that answer. Before we go straight to the heart of the matter, I want to just start by giving you the setup in this second introduction, because the rhetoric here is important for understanding the Maharal's thought, and also just there's something in here that also gives you a sense of the man, because he doesn't mince words, and there's some stuff in here that is very strident, okay? So here he begins on what will be the topic of miracles. That's our main topic. So let's see what he says here in the second introduction. Okay, Haniflaot v'ha'otot v'ha'moftim she'asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'olamo, the wonders and signs and displays that the Holy One performed in the world, and revealing the powers of God to everyone in the world. V'hodia gvurotav, there's that word that is the title, gvurotav, the powers of God to everyone in the world, are certainly worthy of further clarification in order to describe the works of God. So, Yeah, obviously, it's worth talking about and thinking about and contemplating just how great God is. And discussing and understanding God's miracles is how you do that, or is one way to do that. But, however, even af ki livnei Yisrael hamaminim, even though the children of Israel, the faithful, enam chokrim besichlam uvamachshavotam ledat dvarim hakamusim, ein tzarich lezeh. Even though the children of Israel, the faithful, they don't try to investigate with their intellect and their speculations in order to know hidden things. They have no need for this. Okay? Now, this is, just notice that the language here is the same as language we saw before. To investigate, that is language that we saw before. Chokrim, right? What is worthy of investigation? What is permitted to investigate? Right, that's language we saw before, and we are talking about hidden things. So the children of Israel, us, our real true believers, we don't need to investigate the truth of the wonders and signs of the Torah, because they are pure-hearted and they walk in the way of the Torah of God, and they believe all the words of the Torah and the prophets. Yaminu l'chol divrei Torah v'nevi'im. And as for the signs and displays that appear in the Torah and the prophets, they don't attempt to get wise about them. I don't know how to translate this exactly, but lo yitchakmu aleihem. They don't try to make themselves smarter than them. They don't try to get themselves smart by pretending they understand them. There's a certain kind of like trying to get up on or over these things, right? They don't try to get wise about them. By them, it's known that God performed all these powers and wonders, okay? That's an interesting and important place for the Maharal to start, because he's saying, I'm about to explain the inner workings of the divine, but just so you know, real, you know, pure-hearted Jews, we don't need this. We're believers. We're believers. And the important thing is we just believe, and we don't try to know, and that's fine. In fact, there's no need for what I'm about to do. Now, that almost seems like he's saying it's ideal. It's better if you just believe. What do you have a need for all? Why dry me a cup? You know, as they say in Yiddish, like, why mess with my head when I already know? The Torah says, and that's all there is to it. Now, that's an interesting statement of values, because just contrast that with the thought of Maimonides, who is very clear that you need wisdom in order to ascend to God. You need wisdom in order to be righteous. A stupid person, a simple person, cannot attain full righteousness in the Rambam system, which is part of why he's explaining the higher truths to you. But there's a kind of there's an elitism that everybody talks about in Maimonides' thought, where you need wisdom, and wisdom is the way to become fully realized. The Maharal is saying, no, you don't need wisdom. You can just believe. And that's great. In fact, that's the best. However, there's a problem. And even here, the rhetoric is so interesting, because the problem doesn't really start with us, as he describes it. Take a look at the problem. However, ach bo anshei chokrei lev, but then came people with investigative minds. What are you going to do? There are always people like that. Hachokrim misichlam umidatam al Hashem. They start using their intellect and their knowledge to investigate God. Mitpalsim rotsim lahakim al dvarim hanistarim. They are philosophizers who want to get wise by learning hidden things. I am translating this as philosophizers, even though you can see the autocorrect wants me to turn it into philosophers, because he uses the word philosophim in different places. So this, I think, is a little bit like those who try to philosophize, you know, they come in and they're philosophizing, you know, like there's something a little bit sarcastic about this. Like, okay, so these philosophers, they come in and you can tell they want to be smart. They want to pretend like they're smart. They want to get smart from these hidden things. They want to know the hidden things. So they come along and they start speculating. Okay, now, who's this problem philosophizer that is coming in giving us all this trouble? Well, He doesn't say exactly, but the first of these, Hine Rishon Asher Lo Ya'ud Zichro. And we shouldn't even talk about him except to know what to respond to the heretic. That's an edict we get from Pirkei Avot. Know what to say to a heretic, an Epicurus. This is the philosophizer who says that all things come from a known order, the Seder Amuskal, and as part of an eternal existence, a Chiyuv Kadmon, the sort of determination of that which was beforehand. In other words, that everything has always existed and that never has changed or will change. Asher lo sar velo yusar, velo yasur, vehakol kemin hago vesidro nahug. And everything proceeds according to this order. Now, we are most probably talking about Aristotle, and we are most probably talking about Aristotle as filtered through Maimonides, who very famously is a great admirer of Aristotle, but parts ways with Aristotle on precisely this point, the idea that existence always was, that the world always has eternally been. There was no starting point. And that's a problem. It's a problem for Maimonides, who otherwise is willing to go with Aristotle. Maimonides says at one point, if Aristotle hadn't said this, we could just basically become full Aristotelians. But this is a problem because if you say that, you're saying, first of all, that there was no creation. There's no starting point, and that's a direct contradiction to our story. But actually, for the Maharal, it's more than that. It's not just creation. It's miracles. Because if you have a world that is Aristotelian, knowable because of its plan and order and logic and rules, and always operates according to those rules, it's sort of, you know, what will become kind of Newtonian picture of the world, well, then you can't have miracles. Right? You can't have miracles. That's a change in the order of things, and there is a permanent and eternal order of things. Okay, so that's Aristotle beginning to cause problems, and then the Maharal starts turning inward and saying this. And there are even, hine yesh tzat mi chochmei amenu. And there are even a few wise of our people, you know, Rachman al-Atzlan, too bad, there are even some of our people, kmo haralbag, as bidvarav, as the Ralbag in his writings is evidence of, hitchil lachkor, there's that word again, who began to investigate the wonders, v'charze hitchil lachkor, od hanisim, and then he kept investigating into the miracles of, say, the Exodus. Okay, so who's the Ralbag? The Ralbag is a late medieval thinker, late meaning he stretches into the 1300s, so he is generations after Maimonides, and he's sort of throwing the Ralbag under the bus here, Rabbi Gershon ben Levi, Gersonides, we sometimes call him, sort of throwing the Ralbag under the bus, like, oh, the Ralbag, he's really suspect. But the truth is, you know, he's probably also arguing directly with Maimonides. It's just not as, Maimonides is older and bigger and more important. It's harder to argue with Maimonides. And also Maimonides' position is not as extreme. So let me give you very quickly what they say, al regal achas, on one foot. Let me give you a quick summary of the positions on miracles of Maimonides and Gersonides, and then we'll take a look at what the Maharal has to say, which will be really our main piece for the night. The Rambam. What does the Rambam say about miracles? The Rambam uses a statement of the rabbis that God made a tanai, a contract with the Red Sea to split at a certain time. That becomes the basis for Maimonides' explanation of miracles. Because remember, miracles are a problem because either is a natural order or God can do whatever God wants, but then there isn't an observable natural order, natural laws. Maimonides says, here's the thing. God designed the world and could design the world according to certain laws or rules. And the world functions according to those things and it never deviates from that function. It so happens that the Red Sea was programmed from the beginning of creation to split on the day that the Israelites came out of Egypt. That's one of its properties. Just like water is two parts hydrogen and one part oxygen, one of its properties is that it once in history splits. Okay, that's the nature. And so for all the other miracles, they were pre-programmed. And so you can understand that God does have laws for the world, and they are pretty predictable, but there are little codes that tell you when they're going to deviate from the natural order. That's the Rambam solution, okay? Okay. The Ralbag solution is harder, at least for me, to understand, and I am not an expert in these things, but as by way of summary, I will say, the Ralbag solution is no, you can't get out of this just by saying, oh, sometimes things don't act according to their natural law and natural order. In fact, it's very important to the Ralbag, Gersonides, a French thinker, to, I don't know why I'm saying that, just like in my mind, Maimonides is in Spain, so Gersonides is in France. But the Ralbag says basically that no natural law can ever really be undone or contravened. Instead, what you can have is a kind of speeding up of the process or an experience of speeding up of the process. So his example is, can you turn a snake into a staff or a staff into a snake? And what he claims is, sure, over a long period of time, one thing could become the other. Like we can imagine, I suppose, a snake, what's it called, ossifying? You know, there's a better word for this, turning into stone or something like that. And so that can happen over a long period of time. The miracle, I'm not totally sure why this solves all the problems, but it at least allows for a certain kind of consistency of natural law. The miracle is in the kind of rapid, Moshe is able to quickly move through the process of snake becoming staff or staff becoming snake, okay? But that's actually a thing that can happen. And says the Ralbag, so it is with all the miracles. They are things that can happen. It's just a high frequency of those things. And the other example that he gives, the Ralbag, is the standing still of the sun in the battle at Gibeon that Joshua fought, where the sun and the moon, they stand still and allow for, because they need more time to finish the battle. So the day stops, time stops for Joshua and the people of Israel, and the sun just stays in the sky for hours. Okay, that's a miracle. But, says the Ralbag, it's not a miracle in the sense that time stopped. It's a miracle in the sense that people experienced what was natural anyway, but they just experienced the time as being longer. They were more in that space. It was a delayed, you know, instead of a compression, it was a delay of time. But you could see how he's working with a certain kind of physical, metaphysical logic that allows for what's better than this for him than the Maimonidean theory? It is that nothing ever actually breaks the laws of nature. There's just a sort of like, you know, how do you look at it in time? Okay, I'm not even pretending to have explained that perfectly, but that's a basic understanding. Those are answers given by the medieval philosophers, and both of them suggest that miracles in some way are not really miracles. Not really miracles. Those are, we perceive them as miracles, but they're actually part of the natural order. And it's important for Maimonides and for Gersonides to preserve the natural order, because a lot of what they're trying to do is to fit, to reconcile the truth of the Torah with the world around them that they see, okay? With reason, with empiricism, with the natural world, okay? What does the Maharal do? Well, the Maharal, I should say, has one other medieval thinker that he could have gone with, Nachmanides. There's all these Latinized names, but Nachmanides, the Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, who lived in between Maimonides and Gersonides. Nachmanides says, everything's a miracle. What do you mean? There is no natural order. God is in charge of everything. And that's actually an easy answer. Okay, so that answer is already out there. Nachmanides says, what do you mean? We don't have to accommodate the natural order. Whatever God does, God is literally in charge of everything. God can do what God wants. Okay, that's certainly a possible answer that you might think of as on the other end of there's no such thing as miracles. Actually, everything's a miracle. Okay, here's the Maharal's answer. And the Maharal's answer, here's the piece that I think is most important for understanding. If there's anything that we're going to study tonight closely, this will be it. So let's take a look. Okay, here's what the Maharal says. Behold, we will clarify for you Hitba'er lecha amidat Hashem et Yehoshua b'inyan emet. We will clarify you the standing still of the sun for Joshua in truth. Shehadvarim hem kemashma'o legamrei. This thing happened exactly as reported. Exactly as you read it, that's the way it happened. Okay. Well, that sounds like there's no perspective involved. There's no metaphor here. It happened. However, one must look deeply into it to see if the miracle was performed lechola olam, olan lo nasanes ze rak ba'ofekahu. Was it performed for the whole world or only on this horizon? Now, what does that mean? Okay, for it is possible to say that for Joshua and Israel, on this horizon, the sun stood still, and for the rest of the world, it did not. And this is even more wondrous, for it shows the power of God and the wonders, and God's wonders, I should say, and God's wonders. Okay, so let's just stop for a minute and say he's suggested a wild and crazy thing. The idea that somehow, whatever miracle happened, it happened, but it happened only on that horizon. And in fact, he goes so far as to say it only happened for Joshua and Israel. It didn't happen for anyone else. So maybe it wasn't even happening for the people they were fighting. But for Joshua and Israel, it happened. But it happened exactly as you read that it happened. So you might think he was saying, well, it's just they experienced it that way. And it was true for them, but it wasn't true. But he seems to be saying something else, which is that it happened, but it only happened for them, and it only happened in their reality. What does he mean by that? Okay, and here he's going to give an explanation, and we'll sort of grapple with this in the last half hour. Okay, and if one would say, how is this actually possible? How could this actually be? For the sun to both move and stand at the same time, that's not possible. This is exactly what the Ralbag wrote. That's Gersonides. Part of Gersonides' argument, which is that this is two opposite qualities existing at once and that cannot be joined together. Okay, again, a contradiction in the laws of nature. This is exactly what the Ralbag wrote. But we've already said that he was not correct in the matter, for it's possible for the sun to move. Okay. So what is the significance of the Ralbag? The Ralbag is saying something that is... that one idea and its opposite cannot exist in the same time. The sun either moves according to its regular nature or it does not. You can't say that two things, this is either a snake or a piece of wood. This water either splits or it does not. Two things cannot exist that are opposite truths at once. But the Maharal is going to say, yes, two things can exist that are opposite truths at once. And here is the best formulation of that I could think of in his writing. It is possible for the sun to move from the side of its regular function. Ki efshar v'yachol liot shetelech ha-shemesh misad inyana ha-nahug, but stand still from the side of the miracle. V'tiyeh amidala mitzad ha-nes. For it is possible for one thing to be two opposite things from the perspective of its two different aspects. Its nature being one distinct thing, the hateva davar hamyuchad, and the supernatural being another distinct thing, v'shelo bateva davar miyuchad. For there is no doubt that a miracle beyond nature is far greater and more elevated than nature. But these are two interchanging levels. So the sun operated under two aspects at once, in according with these two overlapping levels. It moved in nature and stood still in the supernatural. Okay. So what is the Maharal's answer? And listen, I'm sure, you know, like I'll open this up soon and I'm sure some of you are like, that makes no sense. And what could you possibly be talking about there? But I just want to say the basics of it, which is that according to the Maharal, there are two layers of reality. Maybe there are many layers of reality, but he is talking about two layers of reality. And in fact, the layer of miracles and the stories of the Torah and the stories of the prophets, because remember, the faithful of Israel just believe what they're told or whether they're told by the right scriptures. But all of those things, some of them are hard to believe. I mean, it's hard to believe all the miracles of Egypt. But all of those things, it turns out, happened. They really happened. They are not metaphors, as maybe Maimonides would have it about some of the the language of the Torah. They're not metaphors. They really happen. But they happened in a different dimension of reality. There is a spiritual level of reality, and there is a physical or natural level of reality. And those two layers of reality operate along different rules and principles. Okay? And so this book is here to talk to you about the spiritual layer of reality and to explain the inner workings of the spiritual layer of reality. But, and this is the critical point, we're going to give you that, those inner workings, but those inner workings do not have to be reconciled or correlated with the physical world, with the world of tangible reality, with the world of matter. Okay? So that, in a way, solves the problem completely. I don't have to prove anything about miracles corresponding to the world because they don't. They're happening in some other layer of reality. Now, what it means that Joshua might have been in the miracle, but every other horizon in the world wasn't in the miracle, that there's more to be, it isn't completely clear at this point, but this is a good starting point for thinking about the way the Maharal approaches the truth of, first of all, just Jewish text and story, and but on a bigger level, the truth of God and the spiritual realm, which is to say that realm is a world unto itself, and it has its own rules, and you know that world's the ways of moving about that world may have more to do with intuition and symbol and associations with one idea with another, rather than careful logical analysis. But that's because the spiritual world has its own logic. I said that earlier. It's like, it's not logic and no logic. It's that the spiritual world has its own logic, and we have to understand that world on its own, and therefore on its own terms. Now, I want to come to the close here and leave some time for conversation, but I have a couple of last things that I want to do. And I have, you know, one more introduction, which we'll spend the least time on, but I think will be worth closing with. I want to say, first of all, that some of you out there, if you've taken your Philosophy 101 courses, which is about all I've taken, I'm no expert, but some of you out there are thinking about Plato. And some of you are thinking, this sounds like Plato. There's a world of like this reality, and then there's a higher world, the world of forms. And in fact, the Maharal uses that language a lot of Homer and Surah, the physical and the form of something. And the form of it exists in that higher realm. So maybe the Maharal is just attacking Aristotle, but is in fact a Platonist. And indeed, much of this period, the Kabbalah itself, the Zohar itself, and the Maharal's thought also, is often characterized by historians as Neoplatonic, that is corresponding to a revival, a sort of dissatisfaction with Aristotle, precisely because it doesn't fit a transcendent and romantic religious worldview. I heard a great lecture on this by a guy, a young scholar named Zevi Slavin, on the reemergence of Plato in the years after the Middle Ages and what we call the Renaissance. So maybe the Maharal is in fact a part of this movement and is reading Plato and is describing something parallel to the Platonic idea that there is a higher level of reality that is pure form, pure concept. The essence of things exists there. The essence of beauty and of truth exists there. And our world is just a pale shadow of that. Maybe, but again, we don't know. The Maharal doesn't talk about reading Plotinus. He does mention Plato at one point, but only to dismiss him. Mostly, he seems to be a defender of Jewish thought, and so he's not trying to be cultured and show how much he interacts with the rest of the world, though, you know, again, stories have it that he was interacting with astronomers of his time and other non-Jewish thinkers. So I just want to name that one way of thinking about this is maybe the Maharal is a philosopher, but he's a Platonist. And he believes that like the truest level of reality is a spiritual layer of reality. But it isn't that simple. I mean, he's not just a philosopher here. And there is, though, this sort of binary between the world of forms and the world of matter suggests a kind of well-known philosophical system. For the Maharal, it won't stay there, as we'll soon see and we'll soon close with. he is going, that layer of reality, that upper layer of reality is filled with so many intricate Jewish concepts that, you know, we again have to wonder, well, what exactly is his mysticism? What exactly are the rules that govern that higher order? But I want to say one, I keep saying this, I want to say one last thing before I say one last thing, okay? So before I say one last thing, I want to say this last thing, which is that I just want to say why this formulation that I just took you through was so important to me. Why this kind of thinking, I said it a couple of times, has so profoundly shaped my own religious orientation. And that is because, you know, I went to, when I first went off to yeshiva and encountered the Maharal, I went to yeshiva in Har Nof, sort of good from neighborhood, and, you know, lots of yeshivas there. And I felt in that world that there was a strong insistence on believing in the truth of our Torah and of everything in it, and believing especially in the revelation at Mount Sinai that happened exactly as described. Maharal's words earlier, kemashma'o lagamrei, exactly as reported. And I don't know, you know, I struggled with, do I really believe in that? Or, you know, like, did it happen in history? Or, you know, how do you account for that kind of thing? Meanwhile, the Maharal was a big part of that culture. And I think the Maharal was a big part of that culture because it was important to have a sophisticated philosophical thinker who nevertheless was not interested in undermining or messing or trying to reconcile the religion with historical, you know, philosophical truths, but just sort of was freed by this separate world to just let the religion exist on its own terms. So, you know, so I was introduced to the Maharal, and I do think that the Maharal ended up being, I don't know if it was intended to do this, but it ended up being a kind of a saving force for me in my faith, because it gave me the language to say that I was a believer. That is to say, I believe in the truth of the Torah and of God and of many of the things in Judaism, but I believe in them because I believe in the truth of a spiritual layer to my reality. There is a spiritual world, not some other physical world that is up there beyond the clouds, but a spiritual reality that is true, that is no less, in fact, more true than this physical reality, but it doesn't contradict it. And we don't have to figure out how one thing was true inside of the other. In fact, it's okay for us to assign much of our faith to the realm of the spiritual. And that mattered a lot to me because it allowed me to say that I was a believer, but it also allowed me to say that I was not, you know, I was not leaving behind the world of science, the world of thought, the world of philosophy, the world of investigating things, the world that we are able to investigate. Go ahead and investigate. What do we do with the spiritual later? Well, that is the hidden realm, and we can speculate on the hidden realm. And so it was the Maharal who gave me the power to say that I was a believer, but not just a believer like, well, it's all a metaphor, but actually, no, it's all true. It's just true in the spiritual dimension. And that mattered to me a lot as I was trying to figure out how to count myself among the believers, but not throw behind, you know, the world of the whole world, but the world of reason and philosophy and education and science that I had come from. Okay. All right. One last thing before we close. Okay. The third introduction here. And the third introduction is really interesting because here we have spent time talking about the Maharal, but we haven't talked much about the Golem. And here is a chance to dip into a little bit of that question that we raised at the outset is, how Kabbalistic was the Maharal after all? And what kinds of hidden things was he dealing with? So here's the third introduction. And all that's important, I'm not going to take us through all of it because the hour is late. But what's important here is that he starts can you believe this, by the way? A third introduction. But he starts the third introduction with a verse from Chronicles. And we know this verse from our Torah service, right? Lecha Hashem ha-gedula v'ha-gvura v'ha-tiferet v'ha-netzach v'ha-hod. Yours, O Lord, is the greatness, the gedula, the power, the splendor, the eternity, netzach, and the majesty and the hod. For all that is in heaven and on earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head above all. Okay. Then he quotes the Talmud. Remember, I said he often starts with these quotes from long passages of Midrash or Agadah. He quotes the Talmud, and he quotes the Talmud, and in the Talmud it says, oh, Rabbi Shila interpreted this verse as follows. Greatness refers, right, yours is the greatness, that refers to creation, and the power, that refers to the exodus from Egypt. Okay, now, as you can see, that's going to be the justification for the name of his book. Okay? The Gevura, the power of God, is the exodus from Egypt, and that's what he's talking about here. Okay? And at the end of this last introduction, he goes on to say, actually, I'm going to follow the order of this verse, Hagedulah, Hagevurah. I'm going to follow it, and I'm going to write a book for each one of these terms, and there are going to be six books altogether. Here, I'll count them up for you. The six books are going to be the Sefer Hagedulah, the Book of Greatness, the Book of Power, 2, Splendor, 3, Eternity, 4, Majesty, 5, Shemayim Va'aretz, 6, and Mamlacha, the Kingdom, 7. And he explains at the end of this introduction how he's going to do it, and then he ends up saying, actually, I'm just going to start with the second one because it gets a little bit sloppy. Like you feel like maybe he didn't have time to write the first one. But what I want to say here is that this verse and these virtues, the greatness and the power and the glory, and these correspond very loosely, and they're thought to be one of the sources for the 10 Sfirot, right? The 10 divine emanations. It isn't a perfect match, but Kabbalists are always referencing this verse because at least the Gvura, the Tiferet, the Netzach, and the Hod, these are all on the classic list of the 10 Sfirot, the 10 divine emanations. And the Maharal goes on, in fact, to name his next book Tiferet Yisrael, and the book after that Netzach Yisrael. So the Maharal, it seems, is referencing the Sfirot, the 10 divine emanations. In fact, the way he names his books is in line with the Sfirot. It's almost like the biggest wink you could have, like, yes, I am familiar with the Sfirot. I am actually going to be naming my book in line with the Sfirot. And take a look at what the Maharal says about this passage. He says, and this makes it seem even more like he's familiar with the Sfirot. He says, it's worth wondering, Ra'ui Litmoa, as the Midrash says, why the verse mentions these things in particular. Why these particular attributes? And the explanation is that it comes to tell us that everything is connected to the blessed God. All the changes in existence and the various changing forces, all of them are God's. And these changes are brought about by the opposition between various parts. Achalakim hamitnagdim zeleze, and that are all separated out from one another. Okay, now that sounds a little abstract, sure, but it definitely sounds like what he's talking about is the many parts of God that are all kind of working in some great system that aren't all the same, but are all in fact parts of God. All of this sounds a lot like the Sfirot, like the 10 divine emanations. It sounds a lot like the Kabbalah from Sfat, but maybe he's doing exactly what we said he was doing at the outside, which is creating a philosophical language for the Sfirot, for the 10 divine emanations, or at least for some of them. However, he never mentions the Sfirot, and to be honest, this verse is not exactly the Sfirot. It's a different system with different qualities. And the place that the Maharal takes this system, this is the last thing we'll read tonight, is he says something that is very different from the doctrine of the Sfirot. He says, the elements that stand in opposition to one another and separate out from one another in the beginning are the six sides of the world, which are the four directions, northwest, east, south, up and down, and that's six, which are divided so that each side is opposite one another, and then there is the seventh, which is the middle, which stands in opposition to them all. And for each of these seven, there are various qualities which are associated with each one. Okay, now, he's just described as sort of like, the reason that God is described with these sort of seven attributes is to give reference to the spatial reality of the world. That when God starts to make a world, God makes a world with direction and space. And then there's a seventh quality, that quality of Shabbat that is in the middle of the six-sided space. Now, what is this six-sided space? Is this Kabbalah? Is this the Sfirot? Is this just his way of saying, I'm really talking about the divine emanations, but I'm just giving you another concept you can play with to think about them? So I don't know. I'm not sure, but I think it remains an open question, and I think scholars continue to debate, what exactly is the Maharal offering us? Is the Maharal offering us a way of getting into Kabbalah, but putting it in abstract or conceptual language that we can process? Or does the Maharal have a system of his own that is, yes, influenced by some of the same forces that the Arizal is influenced by? And so he's citing a verse that those who study the Sfirot often cite, but he's got a different reading of that verse. In a sense, he's got his own mysticism, his own Kabbalah, a different tradition. Or maybe he's coming up with a different tradition. He's coming up with a new system. Okay.